and welcome to the Sobre Mesa podcast. My name is Alan Maguire, and today with me I have Joanna Romero, who is a journalist, and she has come to talk a bit about Lisbon and Oporto. So, Joanna, welcome to the Sobre Mesa podcast.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
So I just want to say as well, before we start, that you, one of your podcasts that you did inspired me to start this podcast, so it's kind of like full circle. You did the Fleeras, right? Do you remember?
I do.
What was it called? Red?
Red Hacks.
Red Hacks.
It's all about, you know, I guess, progressive left-wing journalists and how they survive in our current political and social environment.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was your episode with, I think it was Aaron Bastani, and you were talking about, you know, people should just start podcasts. Teaches you loads. And it's true, it does. Mm. So, yeah. So, thanks for coming on.
Mm. Thank you. And that's, very moving to hear that.
So you've written a couple of articles about our topic, which is kind of the changes in the landscape and the cityscape, I suppose is a better word, of Lisbon and Oporto, right?
Yes. I mean, I've written more generally in this particular topic on the rise in cost of living in terms of housing specifically in Portugal at large, and how it has been absolutely astronomical and out of context with, or out, you know, without any comparison to the same degree in the rest of Europe. So it's unfortunately a generalized, very urban based, of course, but unfortunately very generalized across the country now.
So, I mean, you're similar to me that you live outside your home, well, your, I don't know what you call it these days, your motherland or your home country.
Yes.
And I suppose, but you going back, you do see changes that they hit you in the face, right? I mean, you wrote in one of your articles recently that you went back to part of Portugal that you grew up in and that it had changed, you know, rapidly and quite distinctly. So, you know, what were the changes that you saw and experienced?
So I've been living outside of Portugal, you know, sort of throughout the year from the age of 18 onwards, and I'm in my mid-30s now, so that's quite a while. I've lived nearly as long in Britain as I've lived in Portugal. The transformations happening were visible even in my sporadic annual visits, usually around Christmas and summer, like most students and then young adults do. But I think it really hit home when I went to Portugal during the first lockdown in 2020, because of the pandemic. I was living on my own in London, and my parents live alone in Lisbon themselves. And I felt, you know what? I might as well just do a little bubble with them, as they were called at the time. And then I can, you know, my parents are in the 60s. I felt this would be a good way to protect them and also to, you know, not feel as isolated as we all felt, to be honest. And it was a really interesting experience because I ended up spending about 6 months in Portugal, which is something I hadn't done since I was, as I said, 18, which is really, in retrospect, I was still a child. And then I got to witness a lot of the transformations that had been happening all along, but that I only got to see glimpses of, almost as if like staccato changes in a symphony or something. And I got to see them all happening at their actual pace throughout the course of days and weeks and months. Because as we all know, lockdown didn't stop construction work from continuing to happen. It might have slowed down a bit, but it didn't stop altogether in many cases, particularly when it came to, you know, big so-called development projects in you know, premium areas of our biggest cities, across Europe and across the so-called global north. So I got to see that. It was quite impressive, and I guess shocking as well to see that. I mean, when I talk about changes, we're talking about both from the lens of the consumer habits, and then that I noticed from very early on, how things that I suddenly had gotten used to in Britain really were, you know, slowly but surely arriving in Portugal at a pace and a transformative pace. And that, you know, can mean things like, I mean, I'm not going to say fast food, because obviously I did grow up with fast food, but the normalization of takeaway meals, particularly when it comes to lunch breaks, for instance, which always includes the shortening of said break, right? Because nobody wants to eat a sandwich when they can eat a hot meal, except for when they don't have the time to sit down, wait for the hot meal, or heat up the hot meal, or go home for the hot meal, whatever it might be. So all that becoming the norm was one of, it's a good example of something more to do with the lifestyle and consumer habits, and also the sort of expectation of the workday that perhaps wasn't as prevalent in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s when I was growing up in Portugal.
So was Portugal previously like more kind of Spanish in the way that it sort of constructed its working day, you know, with a longer lunch break and then like work until late in the evening often?
Yes, with obviously certain industries being the exception for obvious reasons. As a rule of thumb, especially in sort of city life, service sector or even third sector lifestyle, my parents are both professionals, so that was what I was most in touch with. And most of my family worked in sort of either office work or office similar type of work days. An hour and a half lunch break. I mean, we don't have traditionally, certainly not in Lisbon, the siesta or in Porto, so in the big cities, we don't have that anymore. But, you know, an hour and a half lunch break, even if not necessarily written within your labor contract, would never be sort of frowned upon necessarily. Back when I was growing up, that is. Nowadays, it probably would have been, or probably would be. But back then, you know, the habit of going to your local little restaurant or cafe. And when I say restaurant and cafe, I'm really talking about things that are very almost domestic, you know, homemade environments, nothing particularly fancy. But for office workers to take a break, that would mean sitting down, ordering possibly the lunch menu, but nonetheless, something that is a super hot meal and then dessert and the coffee and all that. Maybe even have a glass of wine or two. None of these things would be considered strange or out of the norm or special occasions. They would be the daily thing. I mean, two hot meals plus breakfast would be the traditional, meal habits, eating habits. Yeah. And I noticed, I mean, a very good anecdote to this is that when I was growing up in a supermarket, be it the small versions of them around the corner in the city center or the bigger hypermarkets, as they're often called in the Iberian Peninsula. So big shopping services, you would never see an aisle with sandwiches and juices, you know, sort of takeaway lunch.
Yeah, yeah.
And about, it must have been around the 2010s, early 2010s, about that sort of turn, maybe just after the financial crash, and maybe there are reasons for that related to the financial crash somehow. I'm not entirely sure. I'm not a sociologist, so I don't want to start speculating here. But it was really interesting that around that time, I would then, like I said, usually because I was a student, I was just about to graduate in 2008. Go into supermarkets over my summer holidays or my short visits home. And then suddenly I start seeing these aisles that were common to me in British supermarkets.
Like meal deals.
Precisely.
And crisps and packet sandwiches of all weird and wonderful flavors. And a great
fizzy drink.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Drink, yeah.
Or, you know, a healthier version of that being, I don't know, a little tiny box of a potato salad or you name it. And that was a total novelty at the time, absolutely marketed as this extraordinary thing that you could now just grab a sandwich. When before, just to give those who don't know these cultural contexts an idea, a sandwich, other than the ones you'd make at home, would be purchased in a cafe alongside, you know, a coffee, effectively. You could, or a bakery, perhaps. You could go in, ask for a ham and cheese sandwich, and that'd be that.
the sandwiches and things, it's interesting that they've started coming into Spain now. First place was like Madrid Airport, but also in the shops in the Atocha station in the center of Madrid. And now they're starting to work their way everywhere, really.
Into daily lives,
Yeah.
I mean, it is. I mean, it's a very anecdotal example, but it shows how things are changing. And then, of course, these are sort of the smaller things that start changing in people's daily lives. But what really started affecting, obviously, people's actual pockets beyond the sandwiches were all these spaces that within real estate that were being transformed into either speculative assets, i.e. turned into, you know, luxury buildings that were only sold to often foreign investors, but some Portuguese investors as well, to be left empty until they then got resold at a crazy profit rate. Or alternatively, commercial premises from shops and restaurants to hotels and short-term lets, which in Portugal, Airbnbs and the like are called local accommodation, and the shortening of that in Portuguese being AL.
I've seen the signs, yeah.
So yeah, so any person who's done a bit of tourism in Lisbon or Porto or any of the, in fact, probably everywhere in Portugal now, will have seen signs, because they're by law required to have a sign by the front entrance with an AL, and that's what it means. It means that that particular property is available or is regulated as a short-term let. Which means, of course, that we're using many of these, especially old buildings in the center of the big cities like Lisbon and Porto, or Oporto, as we say in English, were being used, and these are buildings that were previously in part residential at the very least, being now transformed into non-full-time residential properties. And so the numbers of homes for average Lisboners have been dwindling. They're in the center of these big cities. And their quality has certainly been dropping, while, of course, the prices of those available have been rising substantially. And it said that that was already very visible before COVID, before I spent those 6 months there. But it became completely rampant at a level unprecedented and simply mind-boggling since 2020. It's just been, I mean, I can give you some figures, but
yeah, that was going to be my next question. How much do people spend on rent?
So a recent article in Expresso, which is our main weekly, quoting stats from an organization called Housing Anywhere, which I'll leave the proviso that I've never heard of this organization before, but, you know, Expresso is a good paper, so we'll go with it. You know, we'll add the caveat, but we'll go with it. They suggested a one-bedroom flat, on average, to rent in Lisbon would cost around €2,500. And a room in a shared house would be, on average, €525 a month. Now, that's all fine and well until we realize that the average salary in Lisbon usually goes for €1,500 a month. That's €1,000 less than what a one-bedroom flat would cost to rent.
Wow.
And Eurostat, which is an organization we do have a little bit more trust in, simply due, if not anything else, due to its size and longevity, has recently, I think these are stats from either late last year or early this year, figured that an average Lisboner working in Lisbon with a Portuguese salary will spend 63% of their wage on housing.
Wow.
It's crazy.
I read somewhere as well that minimum wage is, you know, 763.
Yes, that's this year's value. Let's see what the budget for the government's next budget has to offer. But yes, so it's really, you know, and this in a country that has historically had a much lower number of social housing stock than most of the rest of Europe, that hasn't really had any proper policy around housing, certainly around investment, state investment in housing since the revolution in 74 and the years that obviously followed 75, 76, in which a lot was done to improve places like de facto tenements and slums and so on, which brought a lot of, you know, reform to that sector. Right. And so we haven't had really any of that until more recently, when the housing crisis, as well as globally, certainly became a massive problem in Portugal as well.
So is it an extension? Like, an example is in Spain, you know, there was a massive housing crisis around 2010. It kind of then calmed down a bit, and after a long time and a lot of activism, it calmed down a bit. But there still are lots of like underlying problems that are just making things progressively worse. And I mean, you mentioned like financial speculation in, and I suppose a lot of that's in like the center of the cities, right? Like very prime areas. But there's also the local nets for holidays. And I read in one of your articles, the other problem was kind of the golden visa thing. Golden visas, yes, and digital nomads was one of the problems. Could you expand a bit on those?
Of course. So golden visas have now ended, by the way, in late 2021, I believe.
They're still going here in Spain. They're still going now here, I think.
Yes, well, yeah. Like, obviously, global capital has tried to find alternatives to the Portuguese golden visa. So just to explain to any listener who has never heard of this, a golden visa is a scheme through which any investor in the country, either by creating a business that hires or basically invests X amount, which I, to be honest, don't remember, or when it first started in Portugal, invested in a property over €500,000. I bought a property of €500,000+ in Portugal, regardless of where that could have been located, could have access to a visa in the first place. So it would allow them to live in Portugal, have access to the European Union and the Schengen area, for anyone who's thinking in terms of more commercial trade aspects, but also, of course, to anyone else who is not of a European citizenship, after residing in Portugal for 5 years, like it is the law in most European countries and many European countries, one could request Portuguese citizenship. And more often than not, that would be the case, which again would, you know, provide you with a quote unquote more powerful passport to travel around the world and live in the European Union and so on. And that was certainly exploited and explored by many multi-millionaire billionaire from across the globe. And what it caused really was massive cash injection into particularly urban centers, but also you've already alluded to the holiday homes, which often take geographical place on the coast, really, of Portugal. Portugal has, you know, quite a big chunk of coastal space, and it's all very lovely, but it means that there's a big affluence to those areas. At the same time, obviously, spurring on speculation, property speculation, and rising prices to complete new heights. So the golden visa, I can't remember exactly if it was 2014, but it had a massive impact. But I guess it was one of many policies that were implemented during a coalition government of the center right. That was in power in Portugal during the years of the Troika as well, which your listeners might have heard of before, given that you talk mostly about Spain. Spain too had to suffer a lot of austerity measures targeted from Central Europe into these southern European countries. Obviously, anyone a bit more knowledgeable of the situation in Greece about 10 years ago will have heard of this term often. And we had a conservative coalition in power at the time that obviously, like many other governments at the time in Europe, implemented quite draconian austerity measures. these housing policies and programs were part and parcel of that logic of austerity, of cutting costs, of privatization, and of appealing to global capital to come and spend its top dollar, top euro in Portugal as much as possible without taking into consideration the effects it would have on actual Portuguese workers or on wages, which effectively lend itself to the depreciation of Portuguese workers and Portuguese wages. And the other way you could see this outside of the Golden Visa program, for instance, was through a series of liberalization policies within housing. That included, for instance, the end of what were sort of rent controls. I mean, they weren't quite literally rent controls, but sort of checks and balances on rent increases, as well as a series of other sort of the empowering, I guess, is the best way, policies that empowered landlords when it came to evictions and when it came to raising rents, et cetera, et cetera. So, and those were mostly implemented around 2012, which also came along with the legal framework around, at the time, around short-term lets, i.e. Airbnbs and so on and so forth, which obviously, again, also spurred a lot of landlords to think, wait a minute, if I can charge X for a 12-month contract, but charge X plus for a weekend in central Lisbon, I will obviously pick Airbnb sort of style of short-term lets over longer-term tendencies. And yeah, and ever since, really, it's just been spiraling further and further into these exorbitant amounts that we quoted a minute ago.
Okay, and so what about the digital nomads?
Well, this is the other side of things, right? I mean, I think that at the beginning, in other words, before the pandemic, digital nomads were seen as a kind of interesting, curious phenomenon whereby, you know, you saw some so-called hipsters floating around in especially central Porto and central Lisbon again. They had curious jobs that allowed them to work from cafes and all that kind of culture around digital nomadism started popping up, you know, co-working spaces and all of that. And I think at the beginning, whilst they were looked at with a certain amount of skepticism, it was all sort of taken as part and parcel of modern age and not really having a particular serious impact. I mean, there's always people that are a bit cantankerous for this or that and the other, but nothing that was at least correlated or associated with the, you know, massive increase in housing price. Although some people, particularly those who traditionally would have lived in central Lisbon, and that could be, or central Porto. I mean, I know the Lisbon case better because that's where I was born, but the realities of both cities are very similar when it comes to this sort of thing. Portugal has cities that, whilst they do have their social divisions, by geographical social divisions and certain ghettos and all that, from a more class perspective, you still have a lot of working class areas in at the very heart of the city. They might be potentially more white than suburban neighborhoods, for instance, where often a lot of the migrants and in particular those Portuguese people that originally come from or whose families come from former Portuguese colonies, i.e. Portuguese citizens who might not be white, often live in neighborhoods that are in the so-called commuter belt or the suburbs, depends on what you want to call it, around the bigger urban centers. But when it comes to the center of urban centers, you still have several areas, several neighborhoods that traditionally would have had large working class populations. And with digital nomadism and instead the growth of short-term lets and Airbnbs and the repurposing of some empty buildings around those areas because of their particular location turned into boutique hotels or the sort of spaces for pop-up shops of this or that type, it meant that, you know, people were increasingly being outpriced or simply evicted from these spaces. And there were already rumblings around that culture, including digital nomadism. But it was small. However, with the pandemic, as we saw across the globe, we saw lots of people taking the opportunity of remote work as also an opportunity to travel and potentially work in locations that had much lower living costs to their, you know, wages. This is particularly prevalent for workers from the global north going into the global south and increasing the quality of life whilst remaining within the same wage bracket. And that happened in Portugal a lot because the cost of living at that point was still significantly lower than wages in bigger, you know, probably the five biggest world economies. And that is particularly visible from a demographical perspective when it comes to those coming from the US, United States of America, from Germany, France, and from Britain. And so the affluence suddenly of these people, not just as tourists, which already existed, but as residents, became very, very clear. And yeah, you can name a series of other countries, especially across Europe, because obviously in terms of finding, you know, the traveling facility, given the freedom of travel, freedom of movement inside Europe, made that much, much easier. And so you saw that a lot. And these people, as I said, have tendentially bigger salaries than Portuguese workers in the same role, meaning that Portuguese landlords saw a fantastic opportunity to increase their rents, especially after the often losses that they might have had during during the actual lockdowns. And it just again became a spiral. You know, together with that, there was a lot of there were a lot of articles across the international press talking about Portugal as this amazing destination. Plenty of digital nomad bloggers and influencers and you name it, writing about Portugal. Not just the cities, but Portugal in general as a fantastic destination to live in. It's very westernized in most aspects of daily lives. A lot of people speak English or are predisposed to speak a second language other than Portuguese, especially again in urban or coastal, i.e. more tourist-oriented areas. And, you know, quality of life is fantastic, not just from the weather, which I'm sure most listeners can imagine, but also, you know, the foodstuffs and the culinary aspects and the entertainment and, you know, you name it. Whilst coming at that point, so we're talking about 2019 and 2020 in particular, at a much lower cost than we can witness now 3 years later. Yeah. And then it meant that in the space of about 3 years, we've seen a lot of people couple their disgruntlement over the cost of living crisis and the spike in housing prices in particular with foreigners, not necessarily the traditional right-wing rhetoric of the foreigner as the non-white economic migrant or asylum seeker, but actually the tourist and the wealthier foreign resident who had moved either for digital nomadism or just, you know, migration to Portugal, enjoying this fantastic quality of life that Portuguese people themselves were increasingly not being able to enjoy themselves. So that's definitely a more recent phenomenon, but you do see it, a lot of disgruntlement towards that. And you see that also then mirrored in the very same influencers and blog posts and whatnot that you originally saw saying, come to Portugal, this is fantastic, paradise on earth or whatever, to Portugal has become so overhyped, so overpriced,
right.
People are you know, rude and don't welcome you.
And we don't know why. We don't know why.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, there was one in particular earlier this year who I took up a special, I mean, even I was sort of, I can't believe the level of just privilege and unawareness, social and tactlessness, really. It's a guy who brands himself as being the sort of leading person on digital nomadism. He does live in Portugal, and he writes, I think it's a blog turned bigger website. Right. So somehow he has capitalized, made money out of promoting digital nomadism and writing about it and so on, creating content, really. And he had this big, I don't remember if it was a social media post or an actual blog post, but either or, suggesting that, you know, absolutely come to Portugal, but, you know, going to the big cities like Oporto and Lisbon. And literally the line was, getting your sort of legal bit sorted out, like, you know, residency and this and that and the other, find yourself a girlfriend or boyfriend, and then move to the countryside where the air quality is higher, there's much cheaper housing, and you live in peace and quiet, you know, when there's still internet available nonetheless or whatever. And it was just this complete commodified vision of a nation, as if here are all the facilities you need to have the life you want without actually any of the responsibilities being fiscal or even citizens' responsibilities, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Or any of the engagement with local society, with infrastructure, whatever. And at the same time, that criticizing the reason why you shouldn't then stay, by the way, this was the other side of the coin of what this guy was saying, was the reason why you shouldn't stay in Lisbon or Porto is because, you know, like, actually it's dirty and the streets are cramped. They're so narrow. And the rest of the food isn't that great, actually. And the people at restaurants are rude and whatnot. And you just think, like, my God, this completely forgoes any consideration over the culture, the local, just the local history, you know, the history of a nation. And I mean, I find it fascinating how I start sounding a bit nationalistic on this, which I'm absolutely not. I find those ideas or any idea of nationalism absolutely bogus. But, you know, the idea that you don't consider that, yes, of course, Lisbon and Porto have narrow streets because these are cities with over 1,000 years old, you know.
Yeah,
Lisbon,
yeah,
in particular, has entire neighborhoods that were built during, you know, the Moors. Some of them, probably the layouts of these streets existed already during Roman times. Of course they're going to be narrow. Of course they're going to be crooked. Of course there's going to be, like, teeny tiny steps going up rather than some sort of, you know, dual carriageway. And by the way, this person is American, I believe, and not from the United States. So it makes it all the more sort of agonizing that you think your idea of quality of life versus European and certainly Portuguese ideas of quality of life will probably diverge quite significantly.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it drove me absolutely nuts, the level of, like, just aloofness and privilege and disrespect towards others, as simple as that, towards others.
Colonialist mentality, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. There's this neo-colonial mentality that isn't associated with that because these are European, often majority white countries. But, you know, I'm talking here about Portugal, but I'm sure this happens in Spain for certain, and in a lot of other Southern European nations, like Italy and Greece and Malta, you name it. I think it's interesting to observe, because obviously Portugal and Spain in particular have had foreign communities of what are so-called expats for many decades now, British and German in particular, but others too, from other European destinations or countries of origin. But it has a totally different dynamic. Not to say that those enclaves of Brits in southern Portugal were seen as you know, were beloved by Portuguese locals necessarily, but I think there was, you know, there's a history to that. And there is a sense of, obviously, you know, as decades go by, as years go by, and then decades go by, people start knowing each other and understanding each other. And these other communities end up also playing a role within the let's call it indigenous local populations, but either by consuming local products, or even if in the end, you know, the local beans and tomatoes are used to make an English breakfast, but nonetheless, they're shopping from Portuguese supermarkets or whatever, just give you like a sort of silly example. Whilst this new way, you know, which also comes with tools like Amazon shopping and online, you know, purchasing and whatever else, is seen a lot less enmeshed, and also a lot more transitory, right? Like, these are not people that buy houses a lot of them are people who are not seen as people who move to Portugal or Spain in order to stay there and enjoy a lovely final 30 years of life or whatever, but rather as people who've come to enjoy the facilities and will in all likeliness leave, you know, all of them, but in great numbers, within a few years' time, when something else becomes all the rage or cheaper or more convenient, and it has really created a sense of disgruntlement, which is I think ultimately a travesty, because, you know, digital nomadism per se isn't necessarily the problem. The problem is that Portuguese wages continue stagnant, all things considered. There isn't a fiscal policy being implemented either for people who come in and out. And I admit that it would be hard to establish that, but nonetheless, there needs to be a more 21st century thinking around mobility. You know, I am all for freedom of movement, of course, but that has to come with certain rights, but also certain responsibilities,
of course.
And it is that imbalance that stems from a series of other imbalances, both within the European Union but also outside of the European Union, that then, you know, exacerbate the problem of property speculation and foreign investment, really, which ends up not being very investment in the sense of investing in actual local communities or employing Portuguese workers necessarily, but just investment in the sense of buying up a piece of land and transforming into a luxury hotel so that other foreign people who can afford those prices can come and enjoy a lovely holiday or a lovely summer home, or, you know, you name it. The list could go on and on.
I have been to Lisbon recently for a weekend, and I did see, you know, large swathes of land in Cascais just above Lisbon that had been bought for base effectively, you know, luxury tourism, and it was a huge area, and lots of startups as well, the word creative seems to be everywhere, lots of startups and things like that.
These are the two sort of main, I guess, constituencies, really, either sort of millionaires, billionaires, in, you know, buying property or buying luxury holidays, or alternatively, like, people who would be in their countries of origin earning average to perhaps even relatively lower incomes, but then being able to afford a bit more in Portugal, and that often tends to be, as you say, creatives. And also, you know, like, I think a lot of companies are treating Portugal, though that seems to have been decreasing a little bit, like a quasi-fiscal paradise, because in particular, I don't know about general tax, corporate taxes for normal organizations, but I do know that for digital currency, there is no tax whatsoever imposed on profits generated from digital currencies.
Right.
So the biggest cryptocurrency billionaire in the world, of course, lives in Portugal, because he pays no taxes on his income.
Wow.
So you see that sort of thing a lot. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that for now, although it's been, from what I understand, about to change location, the Web Summit moved from Dublin to Lisbon in the last decade.
Wow.
So, yeah, extrapolate from that what you will.
So You said recently in one of your articles, the comedian, Portuguese comedian Faro went viral with regards to his response to, you know, the cost of living crisis and especially the housing. But so what did he go viral for? And generally, what has been the reaction of sort of civil society to this, you know, ongoing process of price increases?
It's really, I mean, it's one of those sort of strange things that happen in our digital age, right? Like Diogo Faro is a comedian, TV presenter. He wasn't very big before any of this. I mean, he was starting to develop a bit of a momentum behind his work. But he used to have a YouTube series or something before COVID that often would pick on social issues or political rhetoric, in particular the rise of the far right, the more sort of parliamentarian far right in Portugal, and sort of, you know, spin it, ironically talk about it or joke. And you know, I don't know, this used to be like 10, 15 minute little episodes of him on the streets doing box bumps or this or that, the other. You can sort of, we can sort of picture the format he was going for. And, you know, a couple of years later, COVID comes around. He's also a Lisbonner like myself. And he was telling me that, you know, like his work dried up a little bit, as it did for a lot of people in the arts and entertainment and in media. And he asked his landlady for a sort of rent freeze or a bit of a reduction, something that could help him continue paying his rent. She said no, and he ended up having to move house. Luckily for him, he was able to find something in his neighborhood nearby for a little bit less, So the story ended well. However, it created a sort of bitter taste and a frustration to the point in which earlier this year, I believe, or late last year, maybe it was late last year, actually, just around Christmas, when new stats over the new rent averages in Portuguese big cities came out, he made a sort of very sardonic video on, you know, like, this isn't this fabulous kind of thing, how we're paying all this when we're still earning half of that per month. That's a very crude summary of the sort of very funny little video that he did. And what happened was that it just had such an uptake because it hit a nerve. Like the audience, which is mostly millennials and Gen Zers, which he's part of, given that he's in his millennial generation rather than Gen Zers, but he is in his mid-30s, but has a sort of very the Gen Zer aesthetic, let's say. Just hit a nerve with these two particular generations, or these two generations in particular. And it just became totally viral. I mean, he had picked up a couple of examples as well from Portugal's biggest real estate website, for instance, and like, you know, one bedroom shoe boxes going for, I don't know, 2,000 euros or something like that. I don't remember exactly the prices were anymore, but, you know, like really ridiculous examples. And he just got, you know, hordes of replies of people saying, examples from, I am a junior doctor or doctor, and my partner is a teacher, let's say something. So I a household with two incomes, and we can't afford to live where we used to. So now we have to move over an hour's commute from where we both work, and we have kids, and we just don't know how to make ends meet. To people saying, and this has become a trope in Portugal, people who cannot divorce effectively. Because they cannot afford to live in separate homes, because the dual income is just enough to be able to afford housing in the location that people need to live, be it because of their family or their work or whatever else it might be. And, you know, so people that live for years with their estranged spouses or even estranged already ex-spouses, this is the thing, and, you know, who want to move on with their lives and are still tethered to their exes because of because of economic circumstance. So you know, it was such an enormous reply to Diogo, to Faro, that he then, together with a few civil society organizations, started a new campaign called Casa un Direito, which literally translates to a house is a right. And they then organized a protest earlier this year in the beginning of spring around the topic. And there was a lot of hope, and to a degree, it didn't kind of happen, that it would reignite the movements of the early 2000s around around austerity and the consequence of austerity, which also meant, you know, like a cost of living crisis as well, effectively, and also a big housing and employment crisis for younger generations. Portugal, I have to say, and again, because I know your listeners will probably be more familiar with the Spanish case, Portugal, unlike other countries in the so-called Southern Europe nations or the quote-unquote pigs, did have a slightly different dynamic, had a massive movement at that time, probably one of the biggest social movements since the revolution in 74. But nonetheless, because of the context of how the austerity measures and the global financial crisis affected Portugal, had slightly different contours. In particular, one should say, unemployment didn't just affect the younger generations. In other words, the discontent wasn't as localized. And as we know, and as we can imagine, younger generations tend to have a lot more energy to mobilize, organize, and cause a big raucous, rather than if it is a bit wider spread, you know, the yeah. problem. So yes, the movement was huge, but you didn't see the level of perhaps radicalism and at times, you know, violence that we saw on the streets of Athens or the streets of Madrid. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it was still huge. And I think a lot of people this year hoped that we could reignite the level of civil society activism and engagement and mobilization that we had seen in the early 2000s. In a way, it hasn't happened yet, but I also wouldn't say it won't happen. It's one of those things that, because the problem keeps happening, because it's very latent, and because it keeps affecting people's lives, it needs is one of those sparks that sort of, you know, let the sort of whole TNT detonate. Let's see. But yeah, but basically the response from civil society at large to this problem, even before Faro went viral, has been twofold. As I said, in terms of activist organizations, grassroots organizations, and some more institutionalized organizations, there's been a lot of campaigns happening around it. There's another quite famous one called Vida Justa, or Fair Life, which focuses not only on housing, but also on wages and policy and infrastructure and social policy in particular. So they go and engage with a lot of social housing neighborhoods and what we call bairros, which are sort of shanty town kind of neighborhoods on the commuter belt of big urban centers of Porto and Lisbon in particular. So they have a slightly different social constituency to them as a campaign, and a slightly wider scope. But both Vida Justa and Casa un Direito often work, if not together, then certainly in tandem, in order to organize protests around the same time. So, for instance, we have a new wave of protests now planned for end of summer, beginning of winter, which end of summer in Portugal can be anything at the end of September to mid to late October. So you have a big protest from Casa un Direito, House is a Right, or Housing is a Right, which is the Diogo Faro, the comedians, or the campaign that he effectively is a spokesperson of. And their big demo is on the 30th of this month, September. And then Vida Justa, Fair Living or Fair Life, having a protest on the 21st of October. So within less than a month's difference, probably I would suggest and I hope that between those two things start boiling and start burbling and, you know, like more happens and momentum is built and so on. But then the other side of all this, outside of civil society, I guess, outside of grassroots organizations, we have seen over the last, well, less than a decade, but certainly since around 2015 onwards, a growing divide within the political rhetoric and the political organizations, and a shift or even a split from the traditional political center. And I think this is of importance because obviously ultimately as it reflects on parliamentary life, it reflects on policy and law, but it also reflects on the zeitgeist and the rhetoric then being used by the average Portuguese, the average voter effectively. And so what we've seen is of course a rise, as I've already mentioned, in the far right from a parliamentary perspective. There is the again, very rapid rise of Chega, which is the quasi equivalent to Vox in Spain.
Yeah.
And a lot of their supporting base comes from particularly this disgruntled the disgruntled groups or the disgruntled communities, you know, this far right organization, Chega Party, it's not a organization, it's actually a parliamentary party, capitalizes on the discontent of these communities living on the commuter belts of big urban centers, not necessarily in the shanty towns. They can live in far more urban areas or urbanized areas, but who are reeling from the de facto death of social mobility in the country, right. I.e. the people who have full-time jobs, bog standard service industry, who thought of themselves whilst quote-unquote growing up or in their 20, 30 years of you know, working and paying taxes, that at least at the end of it, if not throughout, they too would live in central Lisbon. They too would be able to enjoy a nice restaurant meal every other week, if not every Friday, whatever you name it, or every Saturday, who expected to live the quality of life that Portugal sort of promises foreigners and those on the 1% within, you know, the Portuguese wage pyramid that they cannot afford. And these are in particular, of course, white and often working to lower middle class communities. And of course, Chega comes up to them and says, you deserve more. You were promised more. We can deliver more. And of course, it's a fallacy because it's a systemic issue rather than just a particular parliamentary or a particular governmental issue. But this is definitely something that has been exacerbated by the housing crisis and gentrification in Portugal's big urban centers. And Chega has been very smart at exploiting that. But Chega isn't the only phenomenon. It's probably the most obvious and most shocking one, because it then couples all those discontentments and those disgruntlements with anti-democratic rhetoric and xenophobia and racism and, you name, and machoism and you name it, machismo and so on, and transphobia. Anyway, all the ills that we know of our current world. But there's others. There is a splinter within the center right that happened that completely demolished the main sort of opposition to the socialist party, mm-hmm. the center left. And one of the rising stars in terms of political organizations of that has been a party called Liberal Initiative or Iniciativa Liberal. And they too have been capitalizing on this, obviously from a more liberalizing perspective. But for instance, when it comes to housing, they've been able to organize and to a degree actually genuinely mobilize landlords and short-term let owners, so Airbnb owners, to lobby, if not campaign, against any governmental policies that would have attempted to improve the situation in Portugal. And there are, in the most recent case, or the most live situation at the moment, is the government trying to put through Parliament a program, let's call it a housing program, so a package of laws that would not fully ban Airbnb as it happened in some cities in Spain, like in Barcelona, but somehow curtail the expansion of those short-term lets in the city center, and also prevent landlords from just rising rents by beyond market demand, or, you know, one particular policy that was picked up on and turned into something hysterical was the, it was labeled as forcing landlords to sublet their properties to local authorities, local authorities could sublet it to people who, to affordable rents, basically.
Right.
Which was seen as some sort of like the state grabbing private property, and, you know, you name it. The Reds are coming, kind of
vibes
going through the newspapers. And actually, the policy itself, or the law itself, has been in place for a long time. It's an encouragement to landlords to make their spaces available to local authorities, so that local authorities then actually put the money in landlords' pockets whilst, you know, subsidizing these places to those who can't afford to live in central Lisbon anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's really literally a transfer of public to private pockets, public funds into private pockets. But that said, it was turned into just some sort of, like, you know, attack on civil liberties and private property rights and you name it. And this particular package, this housing program, has been vetoed by the president. So we have a sort of constitutional fracas happening at the moment between a president who is, technically a social democrat, which in Portugal, social democracy is the center-right party. Might sound a bit strange to any listeners from anywhere else around the world, but this is how it works. The conservative party is called they're called the social democrats. And the president is a former social democrat leader. Now he is sort of almost like, his own entity floating about. But nonetheless, his politics will always be a bit more conservative than the socialist, the ongoing socialist government. And they're sort of locking horns over this housing program. At the same time, as we have, as I was mentioning, landlords and short-term let owners readying themselves to take the government to court because of this package, whilst on the other side of civil society, you have campaigners and activists preparing demonstrations that will also target the president for vetoing the very same package. So, you know, this is the most live issue we have at the moment. Unfortunately, it isn't as exciting on the streets as one would have hoped, but there is definitely something, fizzing simmering underground, yeah, and possible, you know, it could come to a boil imminently. So yeah, I mean, the political year has just, or the rentrée has just about started. So let's see. But this is really, housing is very much at the center, and gentrification is part of it, is very much in the center of Portuguese political life at the moment.
Thanks very much for your time, Joana.
Thank you. I mean, this was a long chat, and I'm sorry for the indulgence, but I hope it's given a comprehensive summary